Hello and welcome to Interlude, Women's Cancer Stories with Dr. Toplinski. I am a medical oncologist and I specialize in treating women with breast and gynecologic cancer. I started this podcast to share the journeys and experiences of women who are living with cancer. Every week, I bring you stories of incredible women who are all at different stages of their cancer journey. We will talk about anything and everything related to the cancer experience. These women will share with you how cancer has affected them and how they are living life despite that. The information discussed on this podcast is not meant to serve as any medical advice, as each patient has a different treatment and experience. It is meant to create a dialogue. Any personal medical questions should be directed to your healthcare team. Cancer brings normal life to a halt. It creates an interlude. Let's talk about it. Today, my guest is Katie Kashmanian. Katie is a middle school principal and was diagnosed with inflammatory breast cancer right before she was supposed to travel to China to adopt her son. She talks about how she coped with her diagnosis and treatment, how she dealt with the aftermath, and how she's spreading the word about inflammatory breast cancer. Katie, welcome. I am so excited to be talking to you today. And tell me a little bit about how you were diagnosed.
So I was diagnosed in 2014, and what happened is actually in the fall of 2013, I looked down and saw that one of my breasts was swollen and really rounded and perfect looking. Like it looked like I had a boob job on one side, just all of a sudden, overnight. And it was really weird. So I talked to my friends about it and they said, oh, it's probably, you know, early onset menopause or, you know, yeah, I'm sure it's nothing. But I do have a history of regular breast cancer in my family. My mom's had it twice, and so I'm always very vigilant. So I did decide to go to a doctor. Now, my biggest mistake was that I didn't go to my regular doctor that I've been going to, you know, since I was young, because I wanted convenience, and I'm very busy. So I went to a doctor who didn't really know me, and he examined me, and he said, well, I don't feel anything. I don't feel any lumps or anything. I'm sure you're fine. When is your next mammogram? And my mammogram was scheduled for February. And at that time, it was October. So he said, oh, you should be fine. You know, I'm sure it's fine. So I waited. I guess I could have been more proactive, but I let myself believe it was fine. And then when I went in February for a mammogram, immediately they told me you have to come back for a biopsy. And I have had biopsies before, so I didn't panic. But when I went for the biopsy, the doctor said to me, do you realize your breast is swollen and the skin is really thickened? And I said, yeah, I had it checked and I was told it was okay. And she said, that's the sign of a rare and very aggressive form of breast cancer and you need to be checked by a breast surgeon immediately. And I freaked out. It was a Friday. It was actually Valentine's Day. And by now, it was late afternoon. I went home. I hit the internet. I immediately freaked out because I saw that there's this type of cancer called inflammatory breast cancer, and it's very deadly. And normally, you're diagnosed at stage three or stage four because by the time it's picked up, because it's different, the cancer clogs like the milk ducts, the vessels in your skin becomes swollen. And so it's already in your skin. So it's a little bit more advanced. So I freaked out and, you know, did all those things that you do, I guess, when you hear you have cancer. And then I went to see a breast surgeon the following Tuesday, and she said it did look suspicious for inflammatory, and she gave me a punch biopsy of the skin. And they also called I got the results of the first biopsy. They told me I definitely have breast cancer. But we were just waiting to see if it was inflammatory. And that Friday, they told me that it was inflammatory. So I started researching, trying to learn everything I could. And that led me to, I think, make some good choices about my care and how to proceed. And it was actually a little crazy because I was a few weeks away from going to China to pick up my son, who I was adopting, a six-year-old boy. And I thought, oh, can I adopt him or should I not adopt him? Because the statistics at the time said stage three, you had approximately 5 years survival rate on average. And stage four would be more like closer in the line of 20, maybe 26 months or so. So I kind of freaked out, you know, and I didn't know what to do. So that's how it all started, the crazy journey of finding out. I've never heard of inflammatory breast cancer. What is that?
So it's super rare, and like you said, and what a crazy story. I mean, and unfortunately it happens all the time that, you know, because it doesn't present so commonly that people aren't sure what it is, and situations like yours do happen. So what happens? You find out you have inflammatory breast cancer, you're deciding, do I go? Do I go to China? Do I get treatment? What happened next?
Well, they wanted to know if I was HER2 positive. Like, basically, they wanted to know if I had positive or negative response. And I was positive, which was a very good sign because that meant that I would respond better to chemotherapy. So at Valley Hospital, when they heard that I was HER2 positive, they said, we're going to get a kid, you know, go to China. They thought that that was a really good sign. I started doing research, and I read how clinical trials can sometimes be, you know, really helpful. I did find out that there's two hospitals, there were two at the time, now I believe there are three, in the United States that have a specialty in inflammatory breast cancer. And one of them was the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute up in Boston, and I have family up there. So I decided, and they had a clinical trial I actually qualified for. So I decided to go up there and consult with the oncologist in charge of the program, Dr. Beth Overmoyer. And I went up and they tested me again, did everything Valley did, confirmed it was inflammatory, told me I qualified for the trial. And I decided I wanted to proceed with the trial. And I did say to Dr. Overmoyer, you know, what should I do? Should I adopt this kid? And she said, go get the kid. You know, either way, no matter what, he's going to be better off. But you should just go get the kid. And I said, well, but what about, you know, my treatment protocol? And the initial part of my protocol was once a week chemo for 16 weeks. And I had to go to China for 2 weeks. So she said, we'll just skip chemo. You know, we'll get it on the back end. You'll skip one of your chemo sessions, but you have to have it like right before you head to China and right after you come back. And luckily I had an aunt and an uncle with a house there that I could stay at. And so I decided, you know what, I'm going to do the Boston thing. And that's ultimately what I did.
And how was it relocating your life to Boston for that, you know, those few months?
Well, what I did, which I know people will think I'm a little crazy, generally, I would drive up to Boston on a Sunday, sleep overnight, have my chemo Monday morning, and drive home Monday back to New Jersey. And it was interesting because I did have kind of a 4.5-hour window till I would really start feeling sick after chemo. And so that was perfect because that's about how long it takes to get to New Jersey from Boston. So it was a little bit of insanity. And I did have a mastectomy, and I did have the second mastectomy later. And both of those surgeries, I did stay up in Boston. But in between everything, I continued to work as much as I could. My district, my boss was very supportive. And they did hire kind of an interim retired principal to step in when I couldn't be there. So that worked fairly well. It wasn't perfect. It was very messy. But that's how I lived for, you know, just about 2 years, just going up and back. And the radiation I did get at Sloan, I suppose, I don't know why I went to Sloan, except that it's not that far. And the radiologist up at Dana-Farber had a relationship with the Sloan radiologist. So that's what I did. And I was able to do that here at home, I guess is what I'm saying. And that's very helpful because you have to go daily. For a period of time. And so that's what I did as far as the radiation goes.
And can you talk about your decision to go in a clinical trial? I think a lot of people are hesitant. They're not sure. There's a lot that goes into going on a clinical trial. What are your thoughts? What are your experiences with that?
Well, you know, just because of the research that I did and the, you know, they always throw out statistics, and who knows about statistics because they change all the time as more research is done and we have advances in the cure of cancer. But from what I read, it seemed that it could really improve your prognosis if you had an aggressive cancer to take part in a clinical trial, because you're getting what researchers believe is the best, you know, they're not going to do a study on a medication that they don't really, really believe in. So for me, it was kind of a no-brainer because I felt like, and really I was getting chemotherapy. It wasn't like I was not going to get kind of a more normal protocol, but I was also getting, you know, medication that other people weren't able to get yet. So that's why I decided to do the trial. And, you know, I was feeling a bit desperate because you go through that whole mental thing, like, am I going to die from this? And if you feel like, gee, what if I only have 5 years to live? You're kind of, I think, more willing to, you know, be aggressive in your approach to the disease to deal with it. So I actually had a great experience. It made me feel, you know, helpful because I wanted my specimens to be part of research studies. And, you know, I was actually, I gave permission for my tissue to be involved in a lot of different studies. I think that's really important, at least to me, to kind of try to help come up with a cure for everybody else. So that part of it was interesting. My oncologist is also a professor at Harvard Medical School. And, you know, so it was just interesting even seeing how that process works, how they gather the specimens. And, you know, it was really kind of fascinating. And at the same time, at least it makes you feel good about something during this kind of awful thing that you're going through.
And that's great. I think it's such a contribution to science, to research, you know, to be able to partake in a clinical trial. So you're driving back and forth from Boston. You're trying to work. Did you have side effects? How did you feel while you were driving, working, doing, living life?
It's funny because I just, in anticipation of this talk, I looked at my, I had made a kind of a blog on Caring Bridge, which is a site where people who have cancer can give their updates. Because when you have cancer, everybody wants to know how you're doing, but it's very emotionally draining to constantly update people or talk to people. You kind of don't want to do that. So if you blog on this site, you can give permission for your friends to see it, and you can give your update in one place. And I found that helpful. So I went back this morning and I was looking at the old, you know, blog entries, because you forget how, you know, a lot of the stuff that was really hard, you kind of forget about. I did have a ton of side effects. I had sores in my mouth and everything tasted different, and I felt nauseous and I couldn't sleep and I was depressed and I was anxious and I had cramping in my legs, and, you know, there were a whole bunch of things. And, you know, your medical team is generally very responsive in trying to help you with those side effects if you communicate about them. And they give you different medicines. And, you know, ultimately, one of the interesting things that happened with me is when everything was said and done, all the chemo, the surgery, the more chemo, the radiation, I had a duffel bag practically full of medications that I would tote around with me. And I didn't feel well. I really struggled at work. You know, that first year back, I think I was out around 19 days sick, and I would have to leave early. I was feeling nauseous and just dizzy and tired and crappy. And it was so hard. And, ultimately I made the decision to ask my doctor if I could be weaned off of every medication that wasn't absolutely mandatory, for my health. So we decided to do that. And also, I should say, I did go into congestive heart failure from the Herceptin. I ended up at Valley at one point during my treatment because I couldn't breathe very well, and they thought I had pneumonia. So they admitted me for that, but then it turned out to be the heart failure. And my heart did bounce back after they took me off the Herceptin. But I do have to, I am on heart medication, and so that's another thing that I've had to deal with. But I weaned off of most of the meds. And I decided I'd just rather have trouble sleeping and take hot baths when my legs cramp up and all that kind of stuff rather than feel sick, you know, feel dizzy and not be able to work. So that helped a lot because I did have, I mean, even to this day, and so I was diagnosed, it's been almost 5 years. And I would say about close to 3 years since I've really been done with active treatment. And it's taken me a really long time to get back to myself. And it's definitely had, work was hard. work was hard. When you're diagnosed, or at least when I was, the amount of support was unbelievable. The outpouring, the caring. And I am kind of in a community, and so a lot of people know me because I'm the principal, and all the people who work for me and all the students, everybody was amazing in how kind they were. And I think there's such a misunderstanding about the end of a really traumatic cancer treatment protocol, how you are when you're quote unquote done. Like when you come back to work and everybody thinks she's done now, you know, she's in remission, you know, she should be fine. And they have no idea how hard it is. Like for the first year, even just to stand up, I would have to say to myself in my head, all right, time to stand up now, time to get up. You can do it. Let's get up. And how that looks to someone else is, wow, she's lazy. She's sitting too long at lunch. You know, she's not running around the building like she used to. She's, you know, there. I did have to deal with some problems at work with people thinking that I, you know, didn't care. And what makes it that much harder is that you care so much and you feel so guilty because you can't be the person physically that you were before. The other interesting piece is you do, it does, cancer changes your perception of things. So in other words, little meaningless things that I used to get all worked up about, I realized how meaningless those things are. So I'm sure I changed a bit in my approach to things because of going through that experience. So that part of it's been, still to this day is a challenge. Still trying to get back to where we're all on the same page and everything's going okay and there's no resentment and, you know, we're all back together. But
it's really hard, and I hear that a lot from women that, you know, there's a lot of support when you're going through treatment, but then when you're done, you're not actually done. It changes you. You're never going to be done. And it takes time to get back to who you were or maybe a different you.
Right. And I mean, there is some psychological, you know, an aspect to it. If you have a kind of cancer that recurs really aggressively, which mine does. So every time you have a headache or every time your leg hurts, you're like, oh my God, it's back, you know? So my doctor told me there's a 2-week rule. If it's no better after 2 weeks, that's when we worry, you know? So you kind of have to get used to that and just kind of learn to deal with that. And, you know, slowly over time, I have started to regain energy. I mean, even the first time I walked up the stairs to the second floor of my house and didn't really think about it, how hard it was, that was maybe 6 or 7 months ago. And I was so excited because it wasn't hard for me to walk up the stairs, you know, and it hadn't been like that for so long. And, you know, I think my work also had trouble knowing how to handle me. I did, like, communicate with the HR director about how I was feeling, that I was feeling sick, and, gee, should we have the interim come back while I try to get the medication under control? And I kind of got the, oh, no, I think, you know, we got to muscle through, you know, keep it up. I didn't, no one shared with me my rights as far as, like, you know, there are protections in place. I think the Family Medical Leave Act, and there's things like if you did have cancer, they can do, you know, you can kind of ease your way back into work. There's all kinds of things in place, but I wasn't aware of them. And I don't fault my work. I think that they weren't aware of them. And I think through some of the struggles that occurred after I came back, we were all educated on the process of coming back from this and how, you know, how to be supportive and how to help people going through this. So it's, I think it was in that way a benefit to other people who come after me who have the same issue.
So you have a very public job. Did you feel like you had to be open with your diagnosis to your community?
Well, I am a hard on my sleeve kind of gal. I am so transparent as a school principal and just as a person. It's just kind of my personality. And I knew that it was going to impact my job, so my teachers had to know, and my parent community had to know. What I did is I was very proud of myself because we called the staff together and I told them what was going on, and I didn't cry at all, and I was proud of myself because I am an emotional person, got through it, and then they were very supportive. And then with the students, I did do a videotape of myself. I didn't give them, you know, all the gory details. I was very positive and upbeat about it, you know, that this is just something that sometimes we have to go through in life and it's going to be okay. And, you know, I'll be in and out and that kind of thing. And we shared that video with the kids at the end of the school day one day. And they all came. I had kids swarming outside my office door at 3 o'clock. Kids saying to me, you know, my mom had cancer, or, you know, one of the kids said to me, my mom died of cancer, but I know you've got this. And some of the kids were teary, and a letter went out to the parents the same day in the community, letting them know what was happening. And it's funny, it's social media, right? So someone published my letter on like the Ridgewood patch or something. And I did mention in the letter that my doctors felt it was okay for me to continue with my adoption because my community already knew that I was going to be leaving for China to adopt this kid. And there were some hater comments like, oh, perfect time to adopt a kid, you know? But, you know, I think I did it the right way and tried to be upbeat. And the staff was great because they did things like they had the kids make a video for me to the I Am Happy song, Because I'm Happy song, all throughout the whole school. And they sent it to me. And I think that was a way for the kids to get out some feelings about it. The kids made cards for me. And, you know, I think just because of the virtue of having a public life, you have to be a little bit more public. Whereas if I were in a different type of job, I wouldn't have had to be, you know, everyone wouldn't have had to know my business. But that's kind of the way it turned out. And I mean, I work and live in town. My son goes to school in town. I'm really enmeshed in this community. So it would be hard. It's better to get ahead because otherwise the rumors would fly and half of it wouldn't be true, you know.
No, that's so great. And the response from the students is incredible. I mean, that's just such an outpouring of love. So
yeah, one day they also did a pink out where everyone, even the custodians, had pink shirts on. And because my last name is Cashmanian, on the back of the shirt, they wrote, Cashmaniacs got your back.
I love it.
And that was really cute. I pulled in the parking lot. I'm like, why on earth does a custodian have a pink T-shirt on? I had no idea. It didn't click until I walked into the building. So, it, you know, that all that stuff, you know, really helps you get through because it is a hard thing to get through.
When did you go to China? At what point during the treatment?
I believe I had had 4 chemo sessions prior to China. I already was bald. I went in a wig. I didn't tell them I was sick. Shame on me. They didn't ask. I didn't tell. So it wasn't like I lied about anything. I had a friend come with me so that she could help me. And she was a big help because there were times when I was like really exhausted. And it was weird because as soon as we landed in the United States, I had to go up to Boston. And so that was trying to have this poor little kid who doesn't speak English, doesn't know what's happening. And, you know, he's with this woman who, you know, is going, you know. It was kind of a process, and he didn't speak, like I said, he didn't speak any English. Luckily, I have a few Chinese-speaking friends. So at some point, a friend came over, and we told him that I was on a medicine that made me bald, made my hair fall out, but that it would grow back in, and did he want to see? And he said yes, and I showed him, and he could care less. He really didn't care. And, you know, luckily, the kid that he is fit perfectly with what I was going through because he's a very upbeat, happy, resilient. He's not a needy kid at all and very independent. And so, I mean, it was just kind of like everything came together perfectly. As far as that goes, I had been trying to adopt for 5 years and I had from Armenia. I'm half Armenian and I was trying to adopt an Armenian baby. And after 4 years, I said, I'm getting old. I can't, you know, I've got to look into something else. And China does let single women, I'm divorced with no kids from that marriage, but they let single women adopt kids with special needs. So my son was born without his thumbs and he's missing the radial bones in his forearms, so they're a little shorter than normal. But that process was so quick. Within a year, I was going to be traveling to get him. And after 5 years of working toward having a kid, and then all of a sudden you hear, oh, you've got this horrible kind of cancer, you know, and you're just weeks away from being a mom and you've got the bedroom. And, you know, it was a lot of anxiety. I felt so much better when my doctor said, just go get him, you know, just go get the kid. It'll be fine. And it has been. In fact, I would say that having him really has helped me get through some of the harder emotional times with this.
It probably was a good outlet while you were going through treatment.
Yeah, it was. And I had so many friends helping and taking him on play dates and, you know, that kind of a thing. And he would sit in the bed with me. He would come home from school and sit in the bed with me. And we would read or, you know, watch, you know, a movie or something. And we are so close. Like, he's coming into sixth grade and he still comes and sits on the bed with me all the time. And it's because of the way we had to start out with me being in bed a lot of the time.
Did you learn any Chinese?
Booyao. No, I did not. I know like almost nothing. I think booyao means no. Booyao xie xie means no thank you. So xie xie, thank you. No. And poor Sam, my son's name is Sam. He has forgotten all of his Chinese. I took him to Chinese school. He didn't want any part of it. And so now he doesn't remember any of his Mandarin. So I tell him, he wants to go back and visit, and I say, well, how are you going to talk to your, because he had a foster family there. How will you talk to them? And he said, oh, we have friends who speak Chinese. They'll just come with us and translate. So he's not worried. But no, it's such a hard language. I didn't really learn it.
No, it's great. And he learned English super quickly, I'm sure.
Yeah, he did. It's amazing what kids can do. It really is.
So you mentioned when we were talking before this that you really want to educate people about inflammatory breast cancer and what the symptoms are and what to do when you get these symptoms. What have you done in that world?
Well, I am constantly blasting my social media feed on Facebook about inflammatory breast cancer, which I'm sure that all of the people who are friends with me can't stand. And I did send some information to the doctor who misdiagnosed me with a letter just explaining, like not in a mean way, but just saying, hey, you know, you need to know about this. And could you please share this with everyone in your practice so that they're aware of it? Because it was clear to me in retrospect that he had never had experience with inflammatory. And the reason why I said it originally, I wish I'd gone to my regular doctor. She knew all about inflammatory and she probably immediately would have said, you know, Katie, we've got to get this checked because there's this rare kind of breast cancer. So we did that. And my son and I participated in the Jimmy Fund Walk for a Cure up in Boston this year. And we raised about $8,000 between the two of us for research into inflammatory breast cancer. And so those are the things so far. I did have it bothered me, you know, one of the weird things with inflammatory is that it is so different than regular breast cancer. And breast cancer is horrible. It doesn't matter if it's regular or inflammatory, but it is a bit different. And so I wanted a ribbon that was kind of like, you know how they have the little pink ribbon for cancer. I designed one and produced it and gave it out to friends and family and to my oncologist up in Boston that has kind of little flames at the end of the ribbon. So it's pink, but it has little flames at the bottom of it. I'm in support groups and, you know, we do send out things via social media to try to educate people too. Because I tell everyone, I mean, it's just, I wish more people knew that it doesn't have to be a lump. And even my case was a little odd because a lot of times the breast is red. Mine wasn't red. Sometimes it looks like a bug bite. Mine did not do that. Sometimes the skin looks like an orange peel, kind of lumpy because of all those clogged milk ducts, basically those clogged vessels. And I didn't have any of that. Mine was just plump and rounded and perfect looking. And, you know, so to help people know, gee, if something's weird, even if there's no lump, or if you've had something that someone thought was an infection or a bug bite and it's been lasting and not going away, you have to go get checked by a breast surgeon, by a breast specialist. You can't let it go. You know, you can't not to wait because, you know, it was hard. In the beginning, I was searching for survivors online and I wasn't having any luck at all. Long-term survivors of inflammatory breast cancer. Now I know of several, you know, many. And, you know, the one woman I met in person at Dana-Farber, her name was Helen Lipkin. She actually ultimately, she was stage four and she's passed away. So, you know, I just want to mention that one of the things that I think is good for everybody who's dealing with any kind of cancer is to join online support groups, because that's how I got the validation of, yeah, hey, I'm here. It's been 11 years. I'm here. It's been, you know, 17 years. I'm here. It's been 5 years. And you start to build up some hope, and not to count on those statistics that you're reading, which are old. You know, they're from people who are diagnosed years and years and years ago. So I think that's kind of an important thing.
Is there anything that surprised you when you were going through treatment, things that weren't what you thought they would be like?
Yes. Number one, I gained 50 pounds during my treatment, and I really didn't expect that. Although everyone, including my oncologist, tells me I'm insane, I had been eating a vegan diet for 2 years and was in really good health. Then I traveled to Portugal and decided who could go to Portugal and be a vegan. And so I indulged heavily in cheese and, you know, all kinds of stuff. And it was literally 2 months after that that my breast, you know, puffed up and was perfect. So in my head, there's some connection between you stopped doing something really healthy. And I know that there's no basis for that whatsoever in the research. But it you know, it does make me think of that. So the weight gain was definitely something I wasn't expected. I joked with a friend who works in the cancer field when I found out, I said, well, the one perk is, I'll be nice and thin. So I think a lot of people don't realize that sometimes you actually gain weight. One of the things was I couldn't, even looking at any kind of vegetable made me feel sick. Salad, the thought of salad or lettuce. So what I craved almost the whole time, which I've come to find out can be fairly common, is like mashed potatoes or potato chips, carbohydrates. So I wasn't expecting that. I didn't know that my taste buds would change. That was really weird. I didn't really know how a port worked. I did end up with a port to deliver my chemo instead of using my hands. And so that was kind of a surprise. But I'll tell you, the biggest surprise of all was how hard it was after I was done with treatment to try to struggle back to a sense of normal, and dealing with people who had have no understanding of that and kind of the judgment from that. That was a big, 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 big surprise.
I hear that a lot, that you're not done when you're done with chemo. And some people it takes months, and some people it can take years. And for some people, you're never back to where you were before. And it changes relationships. It changes your outlook on life. And that's really why I started the podcast, to kind of share those stories that we don't talk about that often.
Yeah, well, I think it's great just to get that information out. And it's hard, because if I even mention that I'm not feeling well or how I'm feeling, I feel like everyone has the eye roll in their head. You know, here she goes again. Oh, she doesn't feel well. Oh, her, you know. And so I try not to really share how I'm feeling. But then if you don't share how you're feeling and you can't be the way that you want to be, there's judgment associated with that. So It's hard. It can be a struggle. And there was definitely with some people, it was hard for them to understand what I was going through, and, you know, we're still trying to pull everything back to where it was. I mean, I've been the principal at that school. This is my 16th year there. So I've been there a very long time. So this happened after what, like 11 years of me being principal and being a certain way. And then, you know, things changed. And I think it's just a process. And as I get better, everything else seems to get better. Because I'm becoming closer to the person that they expect me to be for, you know, that I was for 11 years. You know, but it's tough. And the emotional piece you can't discount. You have to get help and assistance, especially when you have a type of cancer that recurs aggressively. Because that's always, and even if you don't, I know even for my mom who had breast cancer and then was clear for 10 years and had it again, it's always in the back of your mind. I'm in remission, but is this going to come back? Am I going to have it again? And that takes a big emotional toll. So I think you have to be willing to get professional help if you need it. And probably almost everybody needs it because it really is tough.
If you could give advice to someone who's newly diagnosed, what would you tell that person?
Well, I would definitely tell them to do their research. I do think there's a statistic about how far you travel for your cancer care. So don't necessarily say, oh, that hospital's three blocks away. I'm going to go there. Do a little bit of research. Find the place that's best for dealing with your type of cancer that has the most experience. I was shocked. I should say this is one other thing. I was shocked to find out that the standard protocol of care for inflammatory breast cancer that all these people at these centers like Dana-Farber, you know, promote is not what many, 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 many hospitals in the United States follow. A lot of people are not given the correct protocol. You know, sometimes you have chemo first with inflammatory. You don't have the surgery first. And a lot of places don't follow that, or, you know, they frown on immediate reconstruction because it can mask the regrowth of the cancer, you know, and a lot of places don't follow that. So you really have to do some research. You can't just trust, you know, oh, don't go for convenience, I guess I would say to people. That's a huge piece of advice. You know, this is your life. This is your health. And without that, nothing else really matters. So do your due diligence, do some research, definitely get support from professionals as far as the, you know, psychological piece of it, if need be. And, you know, it's hard, especially if you're a mom or you have a family, because it's not just you, your whole family's going through this and they're having emotions about it too. And everybody really needs support. That's, I guess, what I would say.
It's so true. It's not just the patient that's affected, but it's everyone around them. Last question. If you could sum this up in one word, what would you say?
Well, I'm not going to tell you the word that popped into my head first. Well, I'll tell you, but that's not going to be my final answer. I would say hell, okay? But that's not really true. And, you know, maybe I can't sum it up in one word, but I will leave you with this. I am a firm believer that even the bad, horrible things that happen in your life teach you lessons that help you in your life. And I have learned so many lessons from going through what I've gone through, and I've already been able to help other people that I know going through something similar. And I couldn't have done that if I hadn't gone through it myself. I learned how many people care about me. I learned how freaking strong I am. You know, these are things that I would have never learned without this diagnosis. So, you know, maybe hope is a word that I could leave you with if I had to pick one word.
Thank you so much for being on the show today and for sharing your journey and your experience. It's incredible, and I cannot wait to share it with everyone else.
Thank you so much for having me on and helping me teach people about inflammatory breast cancer. I really, really appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to my conversation with Katie. I can't wait to share more amazing stories with you over the coming weeks and months. If you liked today's episode, please take a moment to leave a rating and review over on Apple Podcasts for the Interlude Women's Cancer Stories with Dr. Toplinski podcast. You can head on over to my Instagram and Twitter at Dr. Toplinski for more podcast info, as well as the latest cancer news and research. Finally, if you or someone you know is interested in being a guest on the show, please email me at interludecancerstories@gmail.com.